Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Division 5 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. Welcome. We're happy to have you here this afternoon. We have a couple of matters on the 130 docket, and I'll call that docket now. The first matter is Casablanca against Caulfield. I presume the council seated at the table are on the Casablanca case. And the second matter is the PFP Family Holdings against Stanley Media Incorporated case. Our council present on that?
Yes, sir.
Terrific. We have, as you know from your information sheets, we've read the briefs. We have been into the record and are familiar with the record. We're familiar with the facts in the case. So if that helps you streamline your presentation, that's terrific. We have a lighting system. I'm sure you're aware of how that works. The yellow light comes on when 5 minutes remain for purposes of calculating rebuttal time. When the red light comes on, you're finished. Ladies and gentlemen who are here and counsel, if you would please turn off any kind of pagers or cellular telephones so that we're not bothered during the argument. With that request, counsel, you may begin.
Counsel, ladies and gentlemen of the court, my name is Lloyd Kordick, and I represented at trial Ms. Casablanca, and I'd like to reserve half of my time, because there are two defense counsel, if I possibly could, Your Honor. At 7 minutes, if I could be advised, I'd like to stop at that point.
I'll let you know when 7 minutes remain.
Thank you, Judge. First of all, this case involved a serious injury to a young child of 5 years of age. She was not capable of being comparatively negligent. The facts are undisputed that she was invited onto a property where wild horses were maintained. That was the status of the case until approximately 8 months after the case had been set for a five-day trial, at which time the defense endorsed four witnesses, lay witnesses, and two expert witnesses. These witnesses were endorsed initially with the report. Mr. Keller was endorsed 75 days before the then trial date. Subsequently, because of a conflict, I was in two trials at the same time, scheduled, and neither court would continue them. I had to start the one trial. The Supreme Court would not give me relief. The judge vacated this trial and set it a few days later. By the time of the trial, the disclosure of Keller was 88 days before trial. Rule 26 provides that in no event shall the disclosure of an expert witness be permitted sooner than 90 days before trial. So clearly, as a matter of law, this was error. We filed a motion to strike Mr. Keller because Mr. Keller was giving the opinion that wild horses were not wild animals. This was an entirely new opinion. It appeared in the record that these witnesses, these two new disclosed witnesses, had been communicating with defense counsel for months prior to their disclosure. Within 7 days, we disclosed an expert witness, a veterinarian in New Mexico, to provide testimony, and we asked the court, since this is a new issue, to either continue the case or let us call him in our case in chief. The court refused. We had a hearing on the matter. We produced 10 days after a detailed report from our expert witness. We also listed an additional expert witness who had experience with horses as much as Mr. Keller and had actually been familiar with these horses and had taken care of these horses. And the court ruled that we could use them as rebuttal witnesses. The court, in setting the trial date, ordered that we be allotted time equally, the defense and the plaintiff, even though we were required to show the circumstances of the occurrence, the detailed medical issues involving my client, which required complex medical evidence, and then also the liability issues. The court ruled that our witnesses could not testify. We think it's an error of law for them to have permitted the late endorsement, which we object to, of Keller. We also believe that it was error for the court, if it did that, not to permit our witnesses to testify in the case in chief. Then 2 days before the trial and the good faith listed witnesses, they say, well, Keller's a will call or may call. Then after we spent $6,000 getting Dr. Gutierrez here from New Mexico, we're told when we start the trial that they're not going to call Keller as a witness. We decide we're not going to call him because we don't want the rebuttal witness.
Mr. Kordick, excuse me for interrupting you, but you've said a couple of times errors of law. As I understand what happened here is the trial judge made a number of rulings that affected the course and scope of the trial. He said, you're going to have 5 days, you're not going to have any more, period. You're going to have to divide your time. He allowed endorsements of witness. She allowed endorsements of witnesses and didn't allow endorsements of others. How are those errors of law?
Well, when the court sets the case for 5 days and then permits an endorsement of 8 additional witnesses, which took almost an entire day of testimony, the court has to make adjustments. We objected to these late disclosures of their expert witness. We were confronted with this issue. The court absolutely would not continue the case. As a matter of law, if we interpret Rule 26 for what it says, in no case will ever an expert be allowed to be endorsed 90 days prior to trial. They should be endorsed or disclosed 120 days prior to trial. That's what the rule requires. But in no case will it be allowed 90 days prior to trial. Even after the case was continued, the endorsement was 88 days before trial. Then, when we endorsed our rebuttal witness, the court would not let the rebuttal witness testify. My client was not allowed to testify in her own case because of time constraints. My expert witness, who sat in the courtroom for days and could have testified had he been allowed to testify in the case in chief, was excluded entirely from testifying. They said, well, we'll let his report in. Well, they also were permitted, during the testimony of Keller, over my objection, I said, this is outside the scope. And she said, no, we're going to let this in. He testified that the burrows were a possible cause of the injury. This was never disclosed in any of his reports. I had a standing objection, and he was allowed to give the opinion that the burrows did it. This prompted a jury question. The jurors started asking questions, well, maybe the burro did it. Well, we sued on the horses because there was evidence the horses were dangerous.
But wasn't that testimony?
We moved to amend this complaint to include that.
Wasn't that testimony about the burros in response to questions you asked?
No, absolutely not. I objected. I asked a follow-up question saying there's nothing in your report that would indicate that the burros caused this injury. And he said, yes, that's right.
It was in response to questions asked by the defense.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. And after an objection, we objected to them going outside the scope of the report. So now we've got a whole new issue about these wild burros. This woman denied they were her burros. She denied that she owned the property. She denied that they were wild animals. She said she got them from some other couple in her deposition. Later, they produced a document years later that they'd had in their possession showing that she had adopted the burros and the horses directly from the Bureau of Land Management. Our witness would have testified that the standard for keeping burros and the fencing requirements set up by the Bureau of Land Management are the same for the wild horses and the wild burros. But since our witness was excluded, we could never present that testimony. The jury found there was a dangerous condition. The jury found that our client was injured. The jury couldn't find causation because the jury was never presented with the option of determining whether it was the burros or the horses. That's why we did not prevail on the case, in our opinion.
You're at the 7-minute mark.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Jesse Brandt, and I'm appearing on behalf of defendant appellee Robert Caulfield, and I'm joined by Mr. Ron Voss on behalf of defendant appellee Mary Port. Before I begin with my argument, I'd like to just point out a few issues that need a little more context with respect to what Mr. Kordick argued. First, the nature of the horses from day one in this lawsuit were always in dispute. It was pled that these horses were wild animals, and dangerous wild animals at that. That was disputed from early on in this lawsuit. Plaintiffs, as the trial date approached, elected not to retain and designate an affirmative expert on the nature of these animals. The defense did.
Mr. Levy, are you going to split your time with co-defendant?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. My name's Mr. Brandt. And yes, I will be splitting my time with Mr. Voss at the 10-minute mark. So one of the complaints raised in the appeal by the Casablancas here is that Dr. Gutierrez was not allowed to testify as a case-in-chief witness. That's a simple issue to resolve. He was not disclosed within the case-in-chief disclosure deadline. The court did allow the Casablancas to call Dr. Gutierrez as a rebuttal witness, and in fact, his report was admitted into evidence. The fact that he didn't testify live was not a result of any ruling by the court, but rather a result of the realities that the time had simply elapsed at trial. And so as a compromise, it was proposed that Mr. Kordick could either have a shortened amount of time to conduct an examination with Dr. Gutierrez, or he could admit his report. He elected to admit his report.
Let me get that straight, counsel. My impression was, under the record, that the court excluded the live testimony of Dr. Gutierrez.
The court provided counsel with an option to do a shortened examination of Dr. Gutierrez or his report, or the admission of his report, which is by stipulation of the defense. Counsel ultimately elected to present the report.
And by shortened, how short did she have in mind here?
I don't recall, Your Honor. I believe it was 15 minutes or less.
So that is short. Okay, thank you.
But the reality is all of the opinions of Dr. Gutierrez that were disclosed, and untimely disclosed at that, were presented to the jury. Now I want to get into this rebuttal case-in-chief issue, too, because that's important. And I think the lines have been blurred a little bit as to what actually happened with the calling of Mr. Keller at trial. Mr. Keller was originally designated by Mr. Voss's client, Mary Poore. That designation was joined by my client. He was identified as a may-call witness on the order of proof. As trial approached, he was not called by the defense, or rather by Ms. Port and Mr. Caulfield. The counsel elected not to call him. However, Mr. Bremer, another defendant, did elect to call him. The idea that the current the appellees here, Ms. Port and Ms. Caulfield, somehow pulled one over by calling Mr. Keller at trial just simply isn't borne out by the record.
Well, why would Mr. Bremer call him? Well, Mr. Bremer was, didn't he have an arrangement with the plaintiff in this case?
Well, there is some evidence on the record that Mr. Bremer was, that's an interesting, let me give you a little bit of history on that, Your Honor, as well. Mr. Bremer didn't initially have counsel when he was brought into this lawsuit, and cooperated with Mr. Kordick throughout the pendency of this lawsuit. And shortly before the trial date, he did retain counsel. And I think there was some discussion on the record as to counsel for Mr. Bremer and counsel for the Casablancas working together. Mr. Bremer's counsel did call Mr. Keller. Neither of the appellees called Mr. Keller.
Yeah, but my understanding was Mr. Bremer's defense was he didn't own the property, didn't invite the little girl on the property. He didn't defend on the basis that these weren't wild animals, did he?
No, that's an interesting issue, Your Honor. Mr. Bremer appeared to be pursuing essentially kind of the same, his defense was similar to the Casablanca's theory of prosecution in this case. They were essentially joined in that theory, and that Mr. Bremer, and I'll let Mr. Voss add anything he wishes to add on this point, but Mr. Bremer essentially argued that because the horses were owned by Ms. Port and the property was owned by Mr. Caulfield, that he had no responsibility.
Yeah, I just can't, I can't imagine why on earth he would call Glenn Keller as a witness.
Well, and that raised some questions, too, as you can see on the record, and there's kind of a lengthy exchange on May 14th about the actual motives or the purpose as to why Mr. Keller was called when the appellees didn't elect to call him.
Counsel, but on that point, the court specifically declined to find or found that, declined to find that there was no improper collusion. Is that correct?
Well, the court, as I read it, the court was not willing to get into that issue, and I think, I believe, directed the court or directed the parties if they felt there was anything more serious than what she had observed to take it to another forum, which is the Supreme Court. But Mr. Keller was allowed to testify.
So in light of that observation, there really isn't a factual predicate for us to do anything on that basis, is there?
No, Your Honor, the trial court did not make that finding. You're correct.
Mr. Brandt, do you agree with Mr. Kordick's characterization of the record then that Mr. Brammer's attorney was the first to inject the issue of the Burroughs into the case?
Mr. Brammer's attorney, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was the first to inject the issue of the Burroughs into the case?
Mr. Brammer's attorney initially called Mr. Keller. I don't recall during what portion of the questioning the issue of the Burroughs first came up, but I would point out in response to how Mr. Kordick characterized the record is Mr. Keller was asked a question about the Burroughs prior to the jury question. There was no objection from Mr. Kordick on that question, and I would be happy to find that particular question for you. So the extent there's any argument now about whether that was a proper line of questioning, we believe that's been waived. Mr. Kordick himself asked Mr. Brammer about the Burroughs. The jury asked Mr. Keller about the Burroughs. Notably, Mr. Kordick didn't object to the jury's question, too, which you would have the right to do so.
If Mr. Brandt, if he didn't object and the parties actually had that issue lodged in front of the jury by consent being that Mr. Kordick didn't object and that the inquiring counsel specifically asked the question about that, why shouldn't he be allowed to amend his pleadings to conform to the evidence?
Well, it's an issue of prejudice, Your Honor, and from, as I mentioned, from day one.
Well, it's not prejudice that the parties consent to the issue.
Well, and there was no consent on the part of the defense.
Well, the question was asked, I take it, by a counsel for either Mr. Caulfield or a counsel for Mr. Brammer or counsel for Ms. Port, and I'm assuming that if you ask a question like that, you're not prejudiced by the response. If the response puts a new issue in the case, the Burroughs issue, how are you prejudiced?
Well, I think it's actually a bit of a larger issue on that, too, Your Honor. It's, as I mentioned, from the beginning, it was always a horse case. And even Dr. Gutierrez, when Mr. Kordick did the late disclosure of Dr. Gutierrez, his opinion is solely focused on the horses. The plaintiff at trial, elicited medical opinion testimony that the injuries were consistent with hoof damage from a horse. So throughout the trial, it was entirely, the entire focus was on the horses. Now the other issue here is the existence of the Burroughs was no secret in the pasture. And had the Casablancas wished to raise that as an issue, they were certainly free to do so. I mean, in this case, I'm not sure the exact numbers, I believe it's a 2002 case, but it had been pending for quite some time, and there had been ample time to amend prior to, I believe the motion to amend or the request to amend came in closing arguments. I'd like to also address another point raised by Mr. Kordick about the timing of the Keller disclosure and whether or not Mr. Keller should have been excluded. Again, I note that neither Ms. Porter nor Mr. Caulfield called Mr. Keller. That was Mr. Brammer. The Casablancas have not elected to pursue appeal against Mr. Brammer. So I'm not sure that issue is properly before the court. The other issue is simply because a disclosure is past the presumptive deadline does not mean that it's precluded. I'm sure the court is familiar with the familiar Rule 37 test, which is either the untimely, if the untimely disclosure was substantially justified or harmless, it does not, the evidence does not necessarily need to be precluded. And in this case, the court addressed any sort of harm that would come from the timing of the disclosure by allowing the Casablancas to present testimony from Dr. Gutierrez, or at least the opportunity to present testimony from Dr. Gutierrez. While he didn't testify live, his report was presented to the jury. So that issue, I believe, is harmless. Pardon me, Your Honor, I see my allotted time is up.
Okay, Mr. Brandt, we'll hear from Mr. Voss, I take it. And Mr. Brandt, I apologize for calling you Mr. Alibio.
Oh, no,
it's not. I won't do that again.
May it please the court, I'm Ron Voss. I represented Mary Port at the time of this trial. I want to address a couple of issues. I can kind of sense the main topics, obviously, with this case. From the beginning, this is a situation in which a little girl had gone into a pasture out in rural El Paso County. And in this pasture were at least two burros, two horses, and whatever other critter might have wanted to be out there, or whatever other individual might have wanted to come on the property at the point in time. So it's always an issue of really what caused the harm to this little girl. Nobody knew. And what happened in this case was that plaintiff in this matter chose to read newspaper articles or TV reports and chose to say that these BLM horses had actually trampled this little girl. And when the only physical evidence of that was a wound that she had sustained to her head, some dust that she had, and some other bruising that could have been sustained from other sources. So from the very beginning, we were never conceding that it was the horses that caused this injury. Yet that was the route that plaintiff chose to take with this. And all the testimony was that these were these wild horses. And the point is that at the time of, one of the first things that came up for me on this when I was trying this case is we took a trial preservation deposition of Dr. Masferer. And Dr. Masferer, whose transcript doesn't appear because it was a video deposition, he had testified, and you can see it from the testimony that came out from Dr. Lohr later, but Dr. Masferer talked about this being a clean cut, a straight edge, a sharp thing. And these horses were out there, they were unshot. And from the very beginning, first of all, in the answer, we never admitted that the horses were wild, never were asked to admit that the horses caused the injury, and we always questioned that. If you take a look at the record on this, from the very first witness that testified, Mr. Hayden, who is one of the first responders, I brought up the issue to him about you can't tell whether this mark came from a horse's hoof, a burro or a mule, or from some other instrument. Isn't that correct? And that's the way I ended my questions. I always pursued this, approached this case as this being an obligation of the plaintiff to prove its case.
Just to be clear, counsel, it was your question then that elicited the first mention of a burro at trial?
For a witness that testified at the time of trial, it would have been first responder Hayden is when that question came up as to what the possibilities could be. But let me follow up on that, because there was no testimony that a burro caused this injury. It's just a question of what caused this injury, and there was no proof on that point. I think that's the significance of this, and plaintiff chose to go that route all the way through trial. And if, for instance, we're talking about amending to conform to the evidence on this case, there was the testimony was that these horses were, because they were BLM horses, that they behaved differently than any domestic animal. Because we wouldn't be here today, there wouldn't be any kind of a case, we wouldn't be having these issues, if we were just talking about a couple of horses and a couple of burros out in the pasture. The only reason we're here is because the assertion that these were BLM animals and therefore dangerous. And the only testimony was in this case that these horses somehow behaved differently. And Mr. Kordick brought on the evidence from Mr. Obar, who is a late endorsed witness. I took a deposition of him late. He testified, gave lay opinion on that. It was brought out by Mr. Archer on cross-examination. And before I run out of time, I want to address a point. Justice Graham, I think you asked this question, why Mr. Bremer would call Mr. Keller. And it does appear on the record as to exactly why he did, because as the judge made a finding on the record, it appeared that they were working together on this case. Well, that was the fact of the matter. They had prepared for trial in this matter, and this was a situation, I'm not I'm just saying that this is the reality of the situation. I'm not asking for any kind of a determination that there's any kind of wrongful conduct about that, but those are facts. They prepared for this case together. It appeared that they were working together, and they called Keller because they wanted to create the need for rebuttal testimony so they could call Gutierrez. That's simple. That's just the facts. And the situation is this. We didn't call Keller. This whole issue about Keller giving this testimony about the Burroughs is a red herring because they created the need for it. They wanted to get Gutierrez in to testify on this case, and what happened is they spent so much time on these irrelevant issues about what happened to Mary Port in the past that they didn't leave themselves enough time after getting warned by the court on several occasions to call Gutierrez in response. And we allowed his report to go into evidence, and that's as good as we could do under the circumstances. But they caused the situation themselves, not the trial court judge, not anybody else. They created this whole situation of error.
Thank you, Mr. Voss. Mr. Kordick?
It pleases the court, Your Honor. With reference to the raising of this issue, the witness, Mr. Keller, first of all, was represented by defense counsel on the record, which I cite in the brief, that he was going to call this witness. And we took the extraordinary step. This witness is clearly outside the 90-day period, which is the minimum permitted by the rule. Never permitted under the rule in less than 90 days. This was clearly less than 90 days. And the substantial justification required in Todd was never made. They never suggested any reason for it. In fact, the facts are they were in contact with both of these witnesses for years preceding the trial, is my recollection. And this was called by Mr. Bremer. Mr. Bremer, when they called the witness, Mr. McCormick examined the witness, and the question about the Burroughs was elicited, first of all, over my objection. They showed a videotape to the witness, Keller, that he had never mentioned or never seen until just the day before the trial. And I told the court, I said, by me, I have a right to voir dire since this is new information that has not been disclosed. The court, no. Mr. Kordick, and I'm going to object, ongoing objection, that none of this was disclosed to me before the court. All right, the objection is overruled. And the court permitted us to have an ongoing objection. Mr. Voss asked the question. Now, I'm talking about Burroughs now. He's asking the question, two, comparing them with horses. Burroughs are a little different. Burroughs are a lot more territorial and a lot more protective of their surroundings than horses are. And for that reason, old sheep herders keep burros around their sheep because they drive coyotes away. They'll attack coyotes. They'll attack dogs that come into the corral. If there's some burros and horses in a corral, the burros will drive the intruders away. The horses will not. Then this prompted juror questions about could the burros have attacked the child. So we, obviously, it was introduced intentionally by defense counsel. He objected strenuously to us amending the complaint to conform to the evidence he brought into the court. And then, in closing argument, he argued to the jury that the Burroughs did it. And I've got the citation of his closing argument. And then the court restricted our ability by adding all of these witnesses and not giving us more time to call our rebuttal witness.
Counsel, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Can you enlighten me about the potential reasons that Mr. Bremer would have called Mr. Keller as a witness?
Absolutely, because Bremer claimed that although it had been reported to him that the horses had attacked Mr. O'Barr, he had heard the horse kick the trailer. It was reported to him by Archer that the horses were dangerous. He had never seen the horses do anything to anybody. And by the way, he testified, he told police initially, and this was in the record, that his daughter had invited my client over to see her kittens. So he admitted to police and at trial that he had invited her onto the premises. He wanted to give evidence, is my understanding, I mean, I can't go into his motivations, that these horses were not, because they were wild, dangerous per se. And then defense counsel, who claimed he wasn't going to call him, introduces this Burro issue and then strenuously objects to amending the complaint to conform to the evidence. And then it prompts jury questions. And the jury found a negligent condition created by the defendants in this case. Now, and they also found injury. But the causation issue, clearly the jury was talking about, was it the burros or the horses? There's no reason that this complaint should not have been amended when they introduced this into evidence. And there's absolutely no reason to permit them, less than 90 days before trial, to come up with two new expert witnesses and then to strike or not permit us to rebut them. They have to allow additional time. If the court's going to make the decision to let more witnesses come in the 11th hour, and the plaintiff goes to the expense of getting a rebuttal witness to this issue that's been put into the mix, the court has to afford the parties sufficient time to put their case on.
Mr. Kordick, if the defendants had Mr. Keller listed as a will call witness by this time, and they didn't call him, wouldn't you have been entitled to an instruction to the jury that they could take an adverse inference from their failure to call Mr. Keller?
I have no idea, Judge. I mean, he said on the record he was going to call this witness, and I've got the quote on here. When he endorsed him, he says, "I am going to call this witness." Based upon that representation, we spent a lot of money to get a witness to rebut it. And then, 2 days before trial, he files a document, which I didn't carefully look at. He says, "Well, I said we'll call." That's 2 days before trial.
I guess my question is,
yes,
is how are you prejudiced if this late endorsed witness, all of a sudden, they decide they don't want to call him?
Well, we're prejudiced because they also endorsed, Judge, four lay witnesses at the same time, which were also late endorsements. And these lay witnesses testified that, and these were also people that collect animals, that were friends of Mary Port, that, oh, these animals were not dangerous. They were mild, meek animals. We had Mr. Archer and we had two witnesses that actually took care of these animals on the property to testify. And she excluded completely Mr. Archer's testimony. She wouldn't let us call him. He was also called by Mr. McCormick, and I was permitted 5 minutes of cross-examination of my expert. I was not permitted to qualify him as an expert or ask him any expert opinions that had been disclosed. And he was the one that took care of this animal and had been attacked by the animal. I mean, the two people were attacked by these horses. So we had a legitimate basis to believe that the horses caused the injury. We had no evidence that these burros ever attacked anybody. But the issue was thrown in intentionally by the defense. You know, I had no control over what questions were asked by Mr. Bremer's counsel in this case. But I did object strenuously to going outside the scope of this report by Mr. Voss, who intentionally interjected it, objected to us amending the complaint, saying that, oh, that would have surprised him after he put it into evidence, and then arguing in closing argument that the burros caused the injury. That's improper. Judge, we have to afford people a right to a fair trial, and implicit is enough time to put your case on. There is no case after this. And one more thing, Judge.
Mr. Kordick, okay. You're finished. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Voss, thank you. Mr. Brandt, thank you. The matter is deemed.